funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We know the war on terror has changed U.S. policy, but what about the core values that lie behind it? As accusations continue to surface about inhumane treatment of detainees at Guantanamo Bay, Abu Ghraib, and other U.S. facilities, many Americans find themselves wondering how we got to this and what happened to our longstanding sense that as a nation, we held ourselves to a higher moral standard than the rest of the world. Jane Mayer is a staff writer for The New Yorker. She has been covering the war on terror since it began and now has put her extensive research into a book called The Dark Side, the inside story of how the war on terror turned into a war on American ideals. Jane, welcome to Think.
Thanks so much. Glad to be with you.
I want to start with this. We have literally ripped pages from the playbooks of the Soviet Union under Stalin and from China under Mao. Is that right?
It's absolutely true. There was One of the things that got me into this subject was just an open question, which was wondering why it was we were seeing the same sorts of strange abusive treatment of U.S.-held captives in the war on terror in Guantanamo and in Iraq and in Afghanistan. And I wondered, you know, could it really be, as the administration was saying, just a few rotten apples at the bottom of the barrel that were freelancing this kind of thing? Just the lowly servicemen, or was there something more to it? Because it seems such a strange coincidence that you would see detainees in hoods and shackles and same stress positions and undergoing the same really kind of weird treatment where they were being bombarded with loud sounds and loud rock music and, you know, heat and cold and sleep deprivation and a lot of things having to do with dogs, people put on leashes, people being sort of scared by dogs. And so I started doing some research for The New Yorker into it and asking people at the top of the Pentagon. And what one of them said to me at the Pentagon at some point was, well, of course, you know, it all comes out of a particular program. And the program, it turns out to have, there was a curriculum for this whole thing. And the curriculum was this program that's called the SEER program inside the Special Forces. SEER stands for Survival, Evasion, Resistance, and Escape. And the SEER program turns out to be a secret program that studies communist and other enemy torture methods. And our services study it in order to be able to train our servicemen how to withstand it if they're ever taken captive, which makes sense. It's a defensive program, and it's been there since the Cold War, and it's, you know, they study even the things Stalin did to get people to give false confessions and show trials. And so the United States military has been keeping this little program going, which studies torture methods. And after 9/11, the strangest thing happened, which was the people who were involved in that program became the experts and the advisors on what the United States should do with our own captives. And so we wound up using the methods of our enemies to inflict mistreatment and some people would say torture on captives held by the U.S.
Well, and the irony here, Jane, I guess, is that we've all sort of forgotten, or the people who were doing this forgot, that the communists were actually trying to extract false confessions. That was their aim.
That's the ultimate irony, is that this is a program, these are methods that were used by just horrible, tyrannical regimes that have been enemies of the United States, and they're methods that we always condemned as torture before 9/11, and they were used specifically for propaganda purposes, which means to get, for instance, the downed U.S. airmen in the Korean War to say anti-American things that were not true. They were means of making captives say whatever you wanted them to say. And so what happened after 9/11, it was really in some ways an amateurish, you know, it was the amateur hour. Basically, the CIA was holding captives for the first time in CIA history and didn't really know how to make them talk. And because it's the military and it's the FBI in this country who are the experts on interrogation, and CIA really has very little history of this. So the CIA wound up asking, what should we do with them? How do we make them talk? And they ended up getting advice from this military program, from psychologists, in fact, who had studied how to subject people to torture and you know, how to break them down psychologically and specifically how to make them make false confessions. So we wound up, you know, unsurprisingly, given this, getting a lot of really bad information in the war on terror out of the U.S. held captives, because we were using methods that had always been designed to get false information.
Another source of inspiration, which is almost hard to believe, is the fact that apparently U.S. interrogators at Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib and other places would watch a show, a fictional show on the Fox network called 24 with Kiefer Sutherland. It's a sort of a terrorism thriller. They would watch that, they would love it, and they would actually learn tactics from the characters on the show.
Isn't that wild? I know, again, talk about the amateur hour. Basically, detainees after January 2002 were flooding into Guantanamo, and they were held by the military, but the military has many proven methods of interrogating people and very, very careful rules about how to do it under the Uniform Code of Military Justice and under the international laws that are also U.S. laws, the Geneva Conventions. But what happened was the Bush administration, right after 9/11, in the White House, decided to toss out all the rule books because they felt that the terror suspects were a new category of person that didn't need to be questioned under the old rules. And so when they threw out the old rules, they had to come up with their own rules. And so the limits were tossed out. The interrogators really didn't know what to do. And so down in Guantanamo, the top lawyer down there, Diane Beaver, has said quite candidly that they were watching 24 a lot, this fantasy, you know, show on Fox TV. And when they were stumped about what else to do, they would just say, well, let's try that. It worked for Jack Bauer, who's the fictional hero on 24. And basically what happens on 24, if you've ever watched it, and I actually spent a lot of time watching it and met the producer of it and interviewed him because it too became one of the templates for the War on Terror. So what happens on 24 every week is that Kiefer Sutherland saves the day and saves America by torturing some, you know, horrible prisoner who instantly coughs up the truth as soon as pain is applied. And they use, you know, all kinds of unconscionable methods that would be completely illegal under any setting. But basically, if, you know, it's Hollywood, and so you do those sort of things in movies and TV. And it always works for Kiefer Sutherland, so they thought it would work for them down in Guantanamo.
And this is also where the whole ticking time bomb concept comes up. A lot of people who say they're opposed to torture will say, well, the one time that I think that it might be acceptable is if, you know, the only way to get information to stop, say, a nuclear bomb was to torture someone, then it might be excusable.
Well, right, and you're right. That one rationale is basically the best argument for torture. And I think almost anybody would say, you know, if they took my kid or something like that, you know, I would gouge their eyes out or do whatever it takes, which is actually the motto of Kiefer Sutherland on 24. But there are a couple interesting things about that. One is that in the people that I've interviewed for this book, The Dark Side, and by now I've spent, you know, years talking to people inside the CIA and the Bush administration. This is based on sources in the top levels of our own government. Those who really know what happened say that we have yet to have come across a ticking time bomb situation. It sounds like the ultimate argument for this, but actually it's fictional so far. There has not been a single moment in our war on terror since September 11, 2001, when there was something imminent about to happen where they needed to torture someone and where they, you know, got some kind of information that stopped an attack. It's always been there's been time and time to use legal methods, which include just plain talking to people, rapport building methods, which is what the FBI has always used and what they recommend and what the military wants to use too. So anyway, there has not been a ticking time bomb situation, and so it's kind of a phony argument, really. And you know, if there were a ticking time bomb situation, I think the other question that's important is, would you want the entire U.S. legal code changed to authorize it, or would you instead want to do what Israel does, which is Israel has outlawed all of these kinds of methods that the U.S. has been using. but they have an exemption. If you were charged with torture and you could argue that you were saving a life and it was a ticking time bomb situation, then the judge can take it into account and maybe let you off. But they don't change the whole legal code to make torture possible for it.
Jane Mayer is my guest. Her new book is called The Dark Side, the inside story of how the war on terror turned into war on American ideals. What do we know, Jane, about the usefulness of torture tactics in yielding good information?
Well, I mean, as you started off the show, the key question is, you know, has this gotten us good information? Since most of these tactics were designed to get false confessions out of people, and unsurprisingly, they've gotten a lot of bad information out of the detainees that the U.S. has held in the war on terror. And there's in some cases, it's been just tragically bad information. In one instance that is just infamous at this point, the United States captured an al-Qaeda member named Ibn Sheikh al-Libi, and he was turned over to the CIA, which in turn turned him over to Egypt, where he was brutalized. And while he was being beaten up and put in cages and, you know, all kinds of awful things happening to him, he told his interrogators exactly what they wanted to hear, because he wanted to make the pain stop. And what they were asking him about, and this was before the war in Iraq, they were looking for evidence on which to go to war. And they asked him if there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And he didn't even really know what weapons of mass destruction were, but he told them, yes, of course there were. And they also asked him if there were links between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda. And he said yes, because, again, he could tell this is what they wanted to hear, at which point they stopped torturing him. Basically, that information went right into speeches that President Bush gave, and also into the most important speech that Colin Powell, who was then the Secretary of State, gave, the speech before the UN in February of 2003, right before the war started, which is a speech that convinced much of the world that we really needed to go and invade Iraq. And what happened was, a year later, almost to the day of after that speech, Ibn Sheikh al-Libi recanted. By then he was in the CIA's hands, and he told them, you know, I made it up. I made it up to make the pain stop. He said, I had to say something. They were killing me. By then, of course, we'd gone to war. By then, Colin Powell had given a speech which he considers the single lowest moment in his entire career, when he realized that the information was false. And so it's a clear example of, if you use these methods, you can mislead your own people into making terrible mistakes. And there are many, many, many examples of that. It's not to say that it always happens, but it's happened enough so that the downside of using these methods has been clearly huge, tremendous unintended consequences of this program.
The title of your book comes from a quote by Vice President Cheney on Meet the Press that happened just after 9/11. We're going to talk about his role in all of this and that of David Addington and other people on his staff. But can you talk briefly about what he said?
Well, he, on the first Sunday after 9/11, Vice President Cheney went on Tim Russert's show, and he said basically, from now on, we're going to have to work on the dark side. That's how these people do it. And basically, we're going to use their methods, was the message. And so my book is trying to explain what the dark side was.
He was telling the truth there. My guest is Jane Mayer. She's a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine. Her new book is called The Dark Side, the inside story of how the war on terror turned into a war on American ideals. If you want to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. The worlds of Manet, Miro, Marx, and Macbeth are yours to explore. Details online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Jane Mayer. She's a staff writer for The New Yorker. She has also been a writer and an editor for The Wall Street Journal. Her new book is called The Dark Side, the inside story of how the war on terror turned into a war on American ideals. If you want to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send an email to think@kera.org. So, Jane, a lot of this seems to center around Vice President Cheney, aided by his legal advisor, David Addington. Can you talk about some of the presidential powers they either strengthened or created with regard to the war?
Well, you're right. And it was really interesting to me to try to sort of figure out where is the push coming from, because it's just amazing how many of the dots go, if you link them, right back to Cheney's office and to David Addington, who is his lawyer and now his chief of staff and probably the most powerful person in America that nobody's ever heard of, really. And they both of them, Cheney and Addington, had been working together for decades. And almost since the Watergate years, Cheney had been chafing at the restrictions placed on the White House, on the president's powers after Watergate. After Nixon overstepped, Congress basically pushed back put a number of curbs on presidential power. So after 9/11, Cheney pretty much used the crisis in the country as a moment when they could lift those curbs. And they also worked with a number of lawyers over in the Justice Department, where they churned out a number of legal memos that argued basically that the president is above the law when it comes to national security issues. That mere laws and statutes passed by Congress saying that, for instance, it's criminal to torture someone could be overstepped by the president if it was necessary to safeguard the country. And so certainly that was one of the major restrictions that was lifted. They pretty much argued the president had the right to do anything he needed to do or wanted to do if it could be argued that it was in the service of protecting the country.
What's interesting is that a lot of people, including those who think that, in fact, the White House has overstepped its bounds, many people say, well, that's a result of the panic and the confusion that took place right after 9/11. But you have a really interesting anecdote to show that while Dick Cheney may have been frightened of a lot of things, he was not operating in panic mode.
Well, I mean, are you thinking of the fact basically he had practiced for crisis for decades. I mean, he'd practiced for doomsday. Cheney was part of a small group that went through secretive exercises for decades before he even became vice president, where they practiced what would happen if there was a nuclear strike on America, and they headed up a kind of an alternative government, which he would be himself under a kind of a bunker about 200 feet below bedrock, where they would, you know, practice running a White House from there. And so when Al-Qaeda struck, he was actually quite cool and calm and commanding and reassuring in the view of some of those working around him. And in the months afterwards, he was subjected to a number of false alarms in the White House, in particular one on October 18th, 2001, when an alarm inside the White House went off, suggesting that there were weapons of mass destruction right there inside the White House, some kind of biochemical or radioactive substance. And Cheney felt that he might have been personally exposed to it. And rather than freaking out, he called the National Security Council to warn them. And so he was pretty cool-headed, yet at the same time, you have to think that at that point, the threat from Al-Qaeda was not just political, it was personal. And they were shaken to the core on some level by this, and maybe their judgment was to some extent shaken by it as well.
Jane Mayer is my guest. Her book is called The Dark Side, the inside story of how the war on terror turned into a war on American ideals. Our number is 1-800-933-5372, and that's where we find Tom in Arlington. Hello, Tom.
Yeah, I'm really glad that your guest is on the show. I saw her on Bill Moyers the other day, and I really look forward to reading your book soon.
Thanks so much.
I read something a few years ago in the middle of all of this where someone said, you know, democracy and freedom are not worth much without the rule of law, and that as we moved into things like Guantanamo Bay and torture, that's what I kept saying to myself, you know, America and Britain before it were based on the rule of law, and that's really what happened in Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union, is that, believe it or not, those regimes were very popular. I mean, Hitler was elected in an election, and it's very popular, and yet they were able to circumvent the rule of law. And I think I'm glad that your book and people in the courts have sort of turned around, and we seem to have turned the corner now where people say we're just not going to allow this in America because we believe in the rule of law. And the people who are standing up are people in the military who believe in the rule of law, and also even conservative people in the FBI. And I think it's great that in this country, it may have taken 4 or 5 years, but in some other countries it never happened. The regime had to completely fall to stop things like this from happening. And I'm wondering what you think about that, and that if you, in the future, you know, if you see this potentially happening again, or if we're going to, you know, if the courts and the military are going to continue to not support this kind of activity being made legal, not just happening, which I think we all know that the police and the military occasionally engage in some violent behavior, but the fact that the Bush administration wanted to make this behavior legal and write it down on paper is what really made it so abhorrent.
Yeah, I mean, for the first time, it became state policy to break these laws and torment prisoners in U.S. custody. It's not that prisoners have never been tormented before. I mean, things go wrong in wars and in all kinds of situations. But this became the American, the law of the land in all but name was torture at this point. And that really is a change for the United States, because we've always taken or tried to take in the high road on this particular issue. So, I mean, I agree. I think the rule of law is fundamental to the United States. I think it's what pulls us, you know, unites us. We don't have a state religion, and we don't have we don't all have the same ethnicity, but we all are governed by the same Constitution and Bill of Rights, and it's something that we hold, you know, very dear. We cherish these values, and so there's also a history in the country where people have panicked in the past and done the wrong thing, but I think the reassuring lesson to me in this time round, and the good news in this book, is just how many fantastic people there were who stood up and stood up for the country's traditions and said, I'm sorry, we're not going to just imitate our enemies. We do have laws, and we're not going to break them. And you're right also that it's not a matter of liberal versus conservative or red states versus blue states. In this particular battle of the hearts and minds on the country about how to fight the war on terror, the people who said often that they were not going to go along and do what they saw as the wrong thing, which would be breaking the laws in order to torment prisoners and take away people's rights without due process, the people who stood up against that were often the military, because they believe there's an honorable way to fight a war and a dishonorable way, and they didn't want to dishonor themselves. And they also were many people inside the FBI who said, you know, we took an oath to the Constitution, and we're not going to, you know, trample on that. And so they refused to participate down in Guantanamo in some of the things that were going wrong. And they stood up and they blew the whistle. And then there were lawyers, Republican lawyers in the administration. And the public really didn't know about this, but there were tremendous fights going on behind the scenes inside the White House, and frequently Cheney's people prevailed. I have to say, many of the lawyers who tried to stop things and put on the brakes wound up having to leave the administration, and they risked their careers for this. But they the fact that they were willing to do that is such an American story too, of people who were just going to, you know, stand up for ideals and do the right thing, even at personal cost to themselves. So I think it's very important that the country, you know, read this history and understand it, because you're right, there may be future attacks, and hopefully the country will have learned from all of this that it's you know, you don't want to give away your whole justice system just to win the war on terror. You can win the war on terror by doing the right thing. And do it in a smart way. In fact, many of the things that they did in the Bush years here, I think, have undermined the ability to win the war on terror, because the war on terror is a war of hearts and minds, and you can't really win it. You can't win over support from the next generation of young Muslims if you're going to wind up torturing their relatives. You know, it. And we've seen America's the support for America has dropped precipitously around the world, and it just makes it harder.
We should point out that there are absolutely some heroes in your book, some people who, despite great risk, not only to their career, but in some cases, people were afraid for their physical safety. And yet they sort of defied what was going on, unsuccessfully in many cases, but they were out there.
Well, it sounds crazy, doesn't it? But there were actually several of the top lawyers in the administration. I mean, you could not make this stuff up. That Jim Comey, the number two lawyer in the Justice Department, and Jack Goldsmith, who ran the Office of Legal Counsel and is now a professor of law at Harvard, the two of them tried so hard to behind the scenes, push the country back into a policy where we were not justifying torture, where the legal footing for the war on terror was legal again. They had to fight with Cheney's office on this, and they became so paranoid about it at one point, they thought they were being wiretapped or that they might even be in physical danger. And so these two lawyers wound up talking in codes. It was an intense atmosphere inside the White House. And I just think it's amazing, given what they felt they were up against, they did do it. They did finally withdraw the torture memo and require that a new one be written that was going to push the government back so that the CIA was no longer justifying the all-out torment of people.
What do you think, Jane, about these accusations that have come out today based on the book by Ron Suskind, that the White House may have ordered the CIA to produce this letter that made it appear as if yellow cake uranium was sold by Niger to Iraq? Do you think there's, I don't know if you had a chance to
hear about it. I've been watching it, and I know Ron Suskind's a terrific reporter. I just don't have the information to say one way or the other whether it's true. I see the White House is denying it strenuously, and so is the CIA. And I have to say, for anyone who picks up the dark side, there have been no denials of anything in it. I mean, it is the record, and it's based on people inside. And so, I feel proud that it's standing up as history. I it's really hard for me to judge that. So I just don't know. There were forgeries, certainly, of and fakery of information that got us into the war. But my sense from my own reporting was that the forgeries were coming out of the Iraqi exile community, particularly somebody named Ahmed Chalabi, who was pushing very hard to get the U.S. into the war. But I do not have any evidence on my own that the U.S. manufactured this stuff and that the White House did. So, I mean, it's fascinating, but it's an incredibly serious allegation. So I'd like to see more about it.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Jane Mayer is my guest. Her book is called The Dark Side, the inside story of how the war on terror turned into a war on American ideals. Let's go next to John in Plano. Hi, John.
Hi. I had a comment first. Last night I was watching TV instead of getting a lecture read of it that I was supposed to be working on, but it was an old episode of Star Trek, and it was exactly what you were describing earlier, where this was one where Captain Picard got captured, and they used a truth serum on him to get him to tell the truth, which was the question I had. But then after they got the truth out of him, then they tortured him with the idea that they were going to get him to say what they wanted him to say, which is what you were describing. But my question was, I always thought there was some kind of truth serum that they could give people to make them tell the truth, sodium phenobol or something. And if that's true, why wouldn't they use that instead of torture, especially in one of these ticking time bomb scenarios?
Well, if there were a truth serum that really worked, they probably would use it. But I don't think that science has quite produced the perfect truth serum, as far as I know. They did. There is some evidence, and I mention it in the book, that they used mind-altering drugs on some of the detainees. And it's more in the form of kind of secondhand scuttlebutt rather than I haven't seen documents proving it, but there certainly is some reason to believe that they used drugs of various sorts on the detainees to try to get them to talk at one point, and which would be illegal, but as I said earlier, that what was considered legal was, the limits were lifted. There isn't anything that even sodium pentothal that just makes people blurt out the truth. If you know, and the CIA has actually experimented over many years with various kinds of chemical substances, including LSD, to see what they could do to sort of get people to talk, and they haven't come across the perfect serum.
Let's talk about Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, because you write in the book that at one point when he was questioned by military investigators, he sounded sort of, the word you use is befuddled, whether he had any idea that his policies had caused prisoners to be abused. And yet there are a great deal of different sources of information that show that he knew what was going on.
Yes, this was after there was an investigation into what went wrong down in Guantanamo, when one particular detainee was wound up with, you know, women's panties on his head and all kinds of other ridiculous things. He said, "Did I ever authorize that?" And in truth, he did authorize that. And there's a paper trail that goes straight up the chain of command in the Pentagon, and also straight up to the top of the CIA and through the Justice Department. And, you know, there's never really been any accountability for the top level of our government. And it's one of the things that I guess I wonder if the next administration will ever hold anybody accountable for this. But the way it's worked so far is that only the servicemen on the very bottom in places like Abu Ghraib have paid a price. But there were policies that justified very abusive treatment of detainees, and those policies were okayed and signed off on at the highest levels of our government.
Jane Mayer is my guest. Her new book is called The Dark Side, the inside story of how the war on terror turned into a war on American ideals. You can join our conversation by sending an email to think@kera.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. Back in a minute.
Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. The worlds of Manet, Miro, Marx, and Macbeth are yours to explore. Details online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Jane Mayer is with us for the hour. She's a staff writer for The New Yorker, former editor and writer for The Wall Street Journal. Her book is called The Dark Side, the inside story of how the war on terror turned into a war on American ideals. Let's speak next to Steve in Euless. Hi, Steve.
Hey, Chris. Thank you very much.
Sure.
Jane, I also saw you on Bill Moyers, and you did a terrific job.
Oh, thanks.
Regarding intelligence, McClatchy did some wonderful stories back years ago about Doug Feith and his special plans and the DOD cherry-picking information. But my main question is, where does all of the theory with the John U. memo and David Addington and Dick Cheney's office, where does that hit the road? There's stories with Colonel Jeffrey Miller, who practiced his craft down in Gitmo and then transferred that to Bagram and to Abu Ghraib. And as you said, with the hearts in mind, that was the best recruiting tool that the insurgents had in both countries to point figures at our rule of law. So do you know anything about Jeffrey Miller?
Well, Jeffrey Miller was an artilleryman who wound up in charge of Guantanamo. And, he didn't know anything about interrogation particularly. And so he was an odd choice to become the man that would spread the interrogation tactics from Guantanamo and on into, as you say, and he did, into Iraq, where he was brought into. He was brought into, as they said, to Gitmoize Iraq. And it wasn't too long after that that the scandals took place in Abu Ghraib, where he in particular had been advising. And, he was a tough guy, is a tough guy who seemed to sanction some really, questionable tactics. If you go back and take a look at the record, a lot of abuse took place during the period when he was running both Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo.
An email from Ian in McKinney writes, I've heard that the administration has claimed that waterboarding and other harsh techniques have elicited some essential and accurate intelligence. Want to know whether you have had the chance to evaluate any of those claims and whether those in the intelligence community have been able to distinguish this supposedly accurate intelligence from false claims to satisfy the torturers.
Well, that definitely is the claim from the some in the intelligence community, and President Bush has said as much, too, and certainly Vice President Cheney. They make it sound like you just turn on a switch and water runs, and 30 seconds later you get the truth. And first of all, I've got to say, it's impossible for anybody outside the program to evaluate this in a really thorough way, because none of us have had any access to it, and they keep it completely secret. So you can't inspect the interrogation logs, and it's made it very hard for anybody to refute the claims. But that said, I can tell you that when the Red Cross investigators went down to Guantanamo and finally got to talk to the 14 high-value detainees down there that the CIA held, including some who'd been waterboarded, the picture they got of waterboarding was very, very different from what we've been getting from the top of the Bush administration. They didn't just do this for 30 seconds. They did it over and over again to people, many, many times, so that there were people, one person was waterboarded at least 3 times in one day and 10 times in 1 week. And you've got to remember that before 9/11, waterboarding was considered torture by the United States and a punishable, prosecutable major crime. And so we were putting people through a very strenuous program of this. It's something, when you talk to people who've been through it in training, they will tell you it is completely terrifying and you feel you're going to die. And it's not just mock drowning. It is partial drowning. Your lungs begin to fill with the water and you think you're going out. And so it was a very tough and extensive program, not just a quick thing. What did they get out of it? You know, there are conflicting claims again. The people who tell you it works are the people who are up to their eyeballs in it. And if they told you they did these things and it didn't work, it would be maybe even more of a disgrace. But they will tell you it worked, if some of them do. And then the very few people with independent access to the information that I know of include, for instance, the top, this Jay Rockefeller, the senator who's the chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee. Maybe somebody who, he's a Democrat and obviously is not implicated in the program one way or the other. He has seen a lot of this information, and he said he has seen not one shred of evidence to make it seem that we had to do these things. And in fact, many, many pieces of evidence and information that make him think that it was a tremendous mistake. So there is another side of this argument, but we haven't really been exposed to it much as a nation.
There are even some questions as to the information that the White House and other sources talked about with Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who had said while being waterboarded that he was the one who beheaded Daniel Pearl, the Wall Street Journal reporter.
Well, right. And there are an awful lot of people who think that the problem is that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed confessed to so many crimes that that people who know a lot about terrorism just basically think that his word is completely dubious at a certain point, including possibly his confession about Daniel Pearl, who was a friend of mine. So I have certainly an interest in seeing that case solved and somebody, you know, paying the price for it. Daniel Pearl was an absolutely wonderful person, and it was just a horrible crime. But Khalid Sheikh Mohammed confessed to beheading Pearl himself, yet most of the people I know who are in the law enforcement community who really know a lot about that case doubt it. And the worry is that you may have somebody who's falsely confessing here who will then let the real killer off the hook by taking the rap for him, and which would be, you know, an awful thing. So it's the problem with using these methods is it taints everything. It corrupts our justice system, and which is real. Our system is based on the closest we can get to science, basically getting confessions that seem true and getting, you know, using scientific evidence, all of which is meant to lead us to the right result in trials. And So when you go back to these medieval methods from the Dark Ages, you get people saying things that aren't true, and it really just mucks up the system.
My guest is Jane Mayer. Her book is called The Dark Side. Let's go next to Fort Worth and speak to Rusty. Hi, Rusty.
Hello. Thank you for the opportunity to ask this lady a question.
Sure.
My question is, first of all, I want to make it very clear, I don't believe in torture, but my question is, has your guest ever had the opportunity to speak to any of the family members that were affected by the 9/11 attack?
Well, as I said, you know, Daniel Pearl was a friend and colleague of mine, and I've certainly spoken to his dad about what happened to him. He was murdered in the most horrible way by Al-Qaeda. And yes, I have spoken. In fact, somebody in my office is a relative of someone killed in 9/11. So, and I, you know, my own family, thank God, survived it fine, but my sister lives across the street from the World Trade Center, and my family are New Yorkers, and my personal family, my husband and daughter, we live in Washington, which was also hit. So we don't take terrorism lightly. What I felt when I saw those pictures in Abu Ghraib, and they came out, and I saw the terror suspects being humiliated the way they were, I didn't feel safer. I've been a reporter in the Arab world, and I just thought, oh, my God, it's going to be a whole other generation before my daughter is safe. Because if you humiliate people like that, you're asking for retaliation, and you're going to make it harder. And it's exactly what's happened is that those pictures of Abu Ghraib and the pictures of people in Guantanamo have become powerful recruiting tools. They're up on every website of the terrorists, and they're the way that they get the young Muslims furious to join in this cause against the United States.
We've now had, Jane, hearing after hearing by Congress about interrogation methods. I don't know if we're up to half a dozen now. But I'm wondering if they make much of a difference, given that these powers were claimed by the executive branch. Does the Supreme Court have to step in here?
Well, the Supreme Court, you know, has stepped in on a number of occasions and has upheld the law. And you've even, you know, even had surprising judgments from Scalia in one case, with, you know, obviously one of the most conservative justices, saying that it was completely wrong of the Bush administration to lock up a U.S. citizen, Hamdi in particular, who was put in a military brig. His rights were taken away from him. He had no right to a trial, no right to a lawyer. Scalia said, you know, this is an abomination and we can't do this in this country. So the courts have stepped in, yet this program persists. And part of it is that that Congress has enabled the Bush administration to go on in this vein. And I think it's going to probably take a new administration to change the rules. And what's interesting is that both John McCain and Barack Obama, I think, are opponents of aspects of these programs and will maybe try to get the country back on a better legal footing.
Torture aside as a tactic of interrogation and war, are you confident, Jane, that the next president, whoever he is, won't want to at least reserve the right to use the kinds of powers in other national security areas that have been claimed by the Bush White House?
Well, I'm never confident because one of the lessons, I mean, really, when you stand back, a lot of what we've been looking at is an abuse of power. And when one branch of the government, the White House, is given that much power with no checks, no balances, no break, Congress basically rolling over and dominated by the same party as the White House, and the courts mostly dominated by the same party as the White House, you've got a concentration of power that is very corrupting in itself. And so if the next administration has the same dynamic, I would never say, well, they'll be angels, because I think human nature is that, you know, power corrupts. But you do have a situation where John McCain has been one of the most forceful and eloquent opponents of torture. He was tortured himself as a POW in Vietnam, and what he said I thought was just really the most, kind of goes right to the heart of the question here, where he says, it's not about them. It's not because we want to coddle the terrorists. It's not about them. It's about us, who we are as a people. And he thinks that torture's wrong and it dishonors us. And, you know, he also knows that all men break at a certain point because he broke himself, and you're going to wind up saying something untrue. So you've got McCain against using torture, and I think that, you know, he would stick to that in the White House. And you've got Barack Obama, who's also spoken out eloquently against using torture and who taught constitutional law himself and I think has a great respect for the law.
I'm going to throw out this loaded phrase now. Do you think members of the Bush administration are guilty of war crimes?
You know, I've been asked this a lot, and it's a real dilemma for me. I'm a reporter looking for the record and the facts and what happened here. So it's I'm not an advocate trying to you know stir up political problems particularly. I'm really trying to inform the country about what happened here. And so I don't know. I mean, I would say in under most systems of law, under international law, which is also United States law at this point, the Geneva Conventions and the Conventions Against Torture are United States law signed by the Senate. Certainly, the war on terror, as practiced by the Bush administration, crossed a lot of legal lines. Things that were done were things that would have been considered criminal in earlier times. That said, I just don't know that the mechanism exists for prosecuting anybody, and I think in the end of the day, it's a political question. Does the public want to see the Bush administration prosecuted for what happened in the war on terror? Because that's what it would take. You'd have to have a Justice Department come in and draw up charges against people. And I as a political reporter, I don't see that kind of demand out there in the country right now. I think people are very upset about what happened. I think a lot of people are thinking again about this and deciding that America took a wrong turn, and they want to see this fought, the war on terror won in an honorable way. But I'm not sure there's that political bloodlust to hold people responsible in a criminal way.
And we don't have much time left, but I want to know why you think, despite all the evidence to the contrary, so many people believe that torture works.
Well, I think, you know, it seems intuitive. You think that maybe if you hit someone really hard, they'll tell you what you want to hear. I mean, and you know, it sounds like a reasonable thing. It's just that those who know the most about it, the military and the FBI, say it ain't so. And that if you want to get good information from people, you've got to kind of be smarter than that. You've got to wheedle it out of them, flatter it out of them, bribe it out of them, give them a plea deal. That's how you get good information.
Jane Mayer is a staff writer for The New Yorker. Her new book is called The Dark Side, the inside story of how the war on terror turned into a war on American ideals. Jane, thank you very much for spending the hour with us.
Well, I'm really glad to be with you. Thanks so much.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.